triangle on the world, being held up by primal figures, Adam and Eve, bonded together to make our understanding of the universe more complete. It's simply like words, algebraic signs, and mathematical symbols, a technical device that solves problems. It divorced itself from meaning. And if your program, whether it be a library or a prison, demands a circle, then you're abusing. And you're not referring to any cultural idea. And you're not referring to any symbolic idea. You are just saying that this form is appropriate for this task. Many architects tried to design with primary geometrical forms at the end of the 18th century, just like they did at the beginning of the modern movement. We'll get to them in a minute. But these who designed at the end of the 18th century were desperately trying to bring back some kind of symbolism into their architecture. Okay, the circle is a pure form. Therefore, the purest men in society, the humble shepherds, should receive the circle, the sphere, as their home. Slightly problematic to fit their closets inside, and also slightly problematic because we don't have the technology to build it. But if once we could overcome the problem of use, and once we could overcome the problem of technology, then we would be expressing architecture as pure geometry. And if we conveniently have the sun rising and setting in relationship to this sphere long enough and strong enough so that the culture could read it, maybe we could bring back a little bit of that symbolism, of that imagery, which had been lost with the transference from the medieval Christian world of belief to the new world of technique and organization. One person stood against this trend of technique. And his name was Piranesi. And Piranesi, I think, was one of the most interesting modern architects. I go so far as to say that his recognition of the dilemmas of contemporary architecture from the middle of the 18th century to the present was such as to make him a postmodern architect. He was both eclectic and rational. He was both emotional and practical. He was both critical and positive. He was both desperate and optimistic. He was walking a tightrope. He was an agonized man. He stood in the middle of the 18th century as someone who sums it all up for us. That's why I'm going to talk a little bit about him now. One of his first drawings from his first book of architecture in the 1740s, he'd been teaching perspective to a lot of students. Teaching perspective, that rule of organization of space, which we've just been talking about. And he draws a very beautiful perspective to show his students how to draw perspective. And just like Gustav Escher in the present, he says, okay, you think you're looking at a series of columns surrounding a great central space. You think you're looking at a Baroque angled view of a perspective organized and controlled centralized space. No. You start to draw a plan of this building, as a modern art historian has done, you find that it is an impossible building. It actually denies what it looks like. What is Piranesi saying? He is saying that you can be fooled, and you can fool yourself if you think perspective is the be-all and end-all of the organization of space. That there is more to it than just spatial order. That somehow the relationship between the eye and knowledge has to have a base which is beyond rationality. And at the same time, look at our world, which was once centralized and whole, which was once symbolic, religious, bonded together, it's fractured. We've lost the center. And maybe it can't hold. And throughout his life, he began to draw these agonized portraits of what he called prisons. But prisons is just a cipher for the world. What is the world of Piranesi's story? The world is inside. This is an inside view, isn't it? Or maybe it's not. This is inside, but it's not. It's outside. The world is therefore both inside and outside. The world is enclosed and powerfully organized. The world is tyrannized by stone and the forces of power. And yet it isn't, because these stones are fractured and broken and collapsed. The walls are breached. The world is cruel, the world has torture involved in it. Here is the modern man looking at the old world of the Baroque that Piranesi saw vanishing in front of his eyes, being tortured by the modern philosopher of reason. And on and behind and always murmuring in the background are the people. The people. In the 19th century, called them the proletariat. We call them the masses. They're murmuring. They have their own will. And they are watching philosophy kill Christianity. Philosophy and reason kill symbolism. Piranesi finds agony in these visions. Stairs move up, they cannot go. Bridges cross, you cannot cross. Towers come down, but displace themselves. Everything is broken apart. Things which should be at the center, this great power of order or this great power of organization for the center of the prison, is no longer at the center. He is celebrating, but at the same time conscious of, a world in collapse. And as such, he tries to pick up the pieces. And where does he look? He looks at the Rome. He lives in Rome, just quite nearby the old Roman Forum, which has not been built over in the 18th century in the way it has today. And he begins to resurrect pieces of Roman stuff, Roman decoration, Roman implements, Roman pieces of Roman buildings, pieces of traces of a culture which was now standing in ruins in front of him. It was an allegory of the ruins that he felt were being presented to him of a world that was passing before his very eyes, the world of faith, reason, symbolism, and belief. But it was also a hope. It was a hope that maybe, against the formulas of reason, against the formulas of mathematics and the formulas of technicians, he could somehow make a last-ditch effort to hold the culture together. What culture? The culture of Rome, the culture of antiquity, yes, but a culture that was going to make out of this collage of pieces of decoration that he picked up like a collector, like an archaeologist from the site of the Roman Forum, and reconstruct and rebuild a grand and wonderful new culture, a culture which was not just based on the principles of geometry and reduced all architecture to spheres, cones, and squares, or a culture which was not just based on the organization of structure, columns, beams, and pediments, but which had decoration, which had vivacity, which had life, which had all kinds of dark and light in it. In the words of the contemporary scene, Piranesi is like Venturian in school, who tried to save culture from the rationalists. Loche and the rationalists, Robert Morris, the geometers, are like Peter Eisenman in this school, who tried to reason out an architecture of pure form. And Venturi goes to Los Angeles, he goes to the Strip, and he picks up these pieces. And he attempts to force them into the fabric of the buildings as if he's reconstructing, or at least re-imaging, a cultural proposition which might hold it together for a little time. Peter Eisenman backs off from society. Says we have to be neoplatonic. We have to stand and be white and pure and cubic, just like the 18th century rationalists. Because only by being pure and cubic can we be universal, and only by being universal can we stand in truth in front of nature. We're being presented in this 18th century with a great cultural reaction against a great rationalist progressive movement. Geometry is being reacted to by culture. Piranesi is saying, look at my Roman ruins. In my Roman ruins, there are fools who stand, there are beggars who sit, there are thieves who squat, there are completely covered with one form or another of human and animal life, vegetation and people. It doesn't matter what class they are, it's all part and parcel of a cultural dream. I don't want to screen out the people, or the decoration, or the art from my picture. I don't want to make it through a construction. I want to make it again as a universal proposition. And with tremendous force, he picks up these pieces and he clamps them onto the facades of these buildings as if to say, here are my cultural layers. Like an archaeologist, we can peel off the layers of this facade and begin to relive the cultural heritage of Rome, antiquity, the heroic ages, and maybe make ourselves men again. He was a tough dude. He had guts. He wanted to say, I want to do it all and put it all together again. It's a cultural vision as opposed to reduced geometrical vision. And yet he knows very, very clearly, and he understands even more clearly, that at the very point he tries to do this, he falls precisely into his own culture, which is a culture of rationalism, is a culture without symbolic meaning. He knows he's eclectic. He knows that it's without end. You can pick up pieces from the forum, so kingdom come, and you still have no more meaning on that facade, no matter how many pieces you plaster onto. And in his resurrection of the plans, the campo martio of this old Roman forum, he does the same in his planning. Just reduplicates the geometrical forms over and over again. You don't know at the end of this particular plan whether one thing's a church, one thing's a temple, one thing's a bar. It doesn't matter. It's a continuous and desperate effort to retrieve a culture. And in trying to retrieve it and invent it for himself, he falls back, obviously, on geometry, the tools and the instruments that the architects have, and eclecticism, the cultural vision that the architect has, you know, post-symbolic, opposed to this world, and he falls into exactly the same trap and exactly the same dilemma. These forms have, in the end, no more meaning. They're just as empty, they're just as technical, they're just as reduplicative. They're like a kaleidoscope which you keep on shaking and you still can't get meaning out of it because it doesn't speak to you. It just continuously reformulates itself endlessly in front of your eyes with given paths. The end, he tried to bind it all up again. Magic circle. He puts his architect's implements, his drawing instruments, in that magic anagram that since the Middle Ages has served to bind up witchcraft, alchemy, and symbolism in one whole. And he tries to say, well, maybe if I make it according to the principles of medieval witchcraft, it will work. Maybe even if I go to the dark secrets of Egypt, I can find some kind a way to bond meaning to the world again, where the world has rejected it. That is, maybe I can find a form that carries a meaning that is not just the form accommodating a function, but has some kind of symbolic carryover. Goethe was another one. He tried very hard to invest with symbolic meaning this little monument that he built in his garden in 1774 in Weimar. Monument to the fortune. What did it mean? It meant stone. He was following the iconography of that great symbolic world of the Baroque, where this was stone, earth, solidity, and this was mobility, power, knowledge. This was stone with a head on it. This was Hermes, the god of knowledge. This was a symbol. It wasn't simply a sphere on top of a cube. And of course, the mondo simbolico, the symbolical world where that meant knowledge, had long passed. And few, except a few romantic symbolists, understood the message of Goethe's monument, just as few listened to the Piranesi. Many tried all kinds of mystical experiments at the end of the 18th century. You've heard of Freemasonry? I just went down your main street and saw a very nice depiction of Son of God standing halfway down the main street. Well, in the 18th century, that Egyptology, the Egyptian form of that Masonic Lodge, had real meaning for its inhabitants. Because they felt somehow that by going to ancient law, this, by the way, is the frontispiece of the Magic Flute of Mozart. Those of you who've seen the opera will understand that it is a ritual Egyptian initiation. Mozart himself was a Freemason. He was trying in a way to say, there are other ways than reason to recover meaning from the world. If we go through these ritual doors, from the most civilized to the most primitive, maybe we'll find ourselves and the world and society again. When you go into those two columns, those two Egyptian columns of the Masonic Lodge or temple in your town, you are going toward ancient knowledge. Or at least, that's how they thought of it in the 18th century. I don't know what they think of it now. You found that your founding fathers used the same symbolism. They were Masons too. They wanted to retrieve knowledge. They wanted stone with a head on it. They wanted an all-seeing eye. They wanted the pyramid of society. They wanted the new secular order. They wanted to build it all. And yet they couldn't throw away the idea that the symbol had to be present and imminent in the life of the society, that it wasn't just going to be a technical organization of orders and classes, and production and consumption. It was going to be symbolically bonded in this iconography. Symbolically bonded in the way this late 18th century, early 19th century Freemasonic painter shows a man who is a Freemason, a brother, holding this sphere completely without touching it by virtue of his bonding to the universal principle. He touches, in a symbolic way, the roots of faith which had been destroyed by rationalism and were now going to be destroyed by social revolution. The people in the streets, 1789, the principles of reason, the principles of equality, why shouldn't we have bread too? This became a continual parade through the 19th century and into the 20th, right through to the present day. The parade of those people who haven't, massed against those people who have. This is not a symbolic connection, although somebody, a high artist like Jacques-Louis David, tried to make it symbolic. Look at him dressing up these people in Roman clothes to make them dignified according to the principles of art, to give them some symbols to which they could recall themselves and see themselves in an orderly manner, make them less of a rabble, perhaps, organize them according to the principles of high Roman ethics, and maybe if they feel themselves like Roman Republicans, they'll start behaving like Roman Republicans and stop massing in the streets and disturbing a revolution which has been very good for me, the middle class, thank you very much, but is not going to be too good for you, the working class. Symbolic form is now used as an instrument of organization of one power over the next. And with the French Revolution, with the killing of the king, with the killing of that power that organized the prospective actions of Versailles and the whole front, with that revolution, you get immediately a sense of history like you've never had it before. A sense of historicity, of the past being cut from, and at the same time the past being open to speculation. You get instant nostalgia, if you like. A nostalgia for a past which can no longer be recaptured. Here we have one of the philosophers of the French Revolution picturing himself, sitting looking at the ruins of great empires and ruminating upon the passage of time, the passage of time which has brought him to his progressive state, but leaves so many empires in ruins. And we can't help thinking, can we not, that our empire too will soon lie in ruins. The white figure of truth walking through the Roman ruins. These nostalgic images of ruined empires, preoccupied and obsessed like a nightmare, those people who would be daring enough in 1789 to break with the past and to make their own future. Just as it still preoccupies the American consciousness, that they have the guts to dare to say in 1776, we will do this. And this is something which was called in the 18th century, taking providence into your own hands. Providence, which had been God's hands, is now in your hands. And immediately you take providence into your hands, you have an immediate insecurity. Because you wonder whether or not you are going to be as fickle, as flexible, and as futile as all the things that you do. And so you endlessly try to rebuild. And throughout the 19th century, this reconstruction of historical precedent over and over and over and over again, this collection, if you like, of historical examples, to have it all within your grasp and you can come and hold it down and somehow keep it from running away and escaping into a timelessness, beset the mentality of architects and their society. The building of antique streets, even the building of landscape ruins, for the delight of the upper classes of France. We can build it. We don't need to study it anymore. We can actually collect it. Here's John Stone at the beginning of the 19th century, collecting the ruins of history and literally plastering them by Pyrenees on the walls of his own house. Fragments of history caught in the hope that in some way or another we can overcome this terrible sense of distance and sense of what the 19th century was to call alienation. This difference between the past and the present, this impossibility of making it for oneself with self-confidence. A number of different forms of expression were tried. A number of different ways of overcoming this crisis were tried. Overcoming the crisis of having to use historical form. For example, it was thought that if man expressed his character on his face, like this man is expressing his character on his face, this man is obviously a dirty old man. He's a literate man. He has nasty, screwed up, pinched up, pursed up lips. He has nasty, bearded eyes. His character as a lecher and a libertine is written on his face. Why couldn't we then take all our modern buildings and write their character on their faces? Maybe that will retrieve some kind of symbolic value for us, some way of expressing ourselves in our new society. Maybe cow sheds, for example, can be built to look like cows. Or maybe we can return to our symbolism and we can make a new religion, this time of Newton, Boulez's great temple of Newton, which he designed just after the French Revolution had broken out, and you can see the light and the dark and the day and the night being brought together in this great attempt, last attempt, I'm afraid, to bring that symbolic meaning, which somebody like Ledoux over here, we've seen this before, had tried to encapsulate his shepherd's skin, whether they liked it or not. William Blake retreated. It was insufferable. He couldn't bear it. The kinds of industrial blight, the kinds of social trauma, the kinds of rationalization, they were too much for his fevered imagination. They were too much for the mind of a poet who wanted to make a heavenly Jerusalem in England, once green but now brown and black and bowed. And so he retreated, with the help of God, the abstract junta, into a vision of abstraction which is now not technical, now not to do with the implementation of function, the kind of packages that Robert Morris was presenting to us over here a little while ago, but simply a cabinet of reflections, a small square room, might have been painted by Cezanne, actually, in the great period. It was actually painted by Blake in 1795. A small square room where you could at once be with yourself and be with the Godhead. Where you can transcendentally and intuitively relate in a mystical fashion, not a technical fashion, not an organized fashion, but again, repeating the symbolic fashion. Well, the world had little to do with Blake. They had little to do with Blake. They called it insane. They invented the categories of unreason, of insanity, especially for people like William Blake. The age of reason had to propose its opposite, unreason, just like the age of liberty had to propose its opposite, confinement. We'll see reason defining insanity and liberty defining confinement continuously in its own practice, in its own exercise. Those people who wanted to go with the tide, who thought it was progressive to be rational, to run with technique, to organize themselves according to the principles of a new rational society, look to the great new ways in which God's domain was being invaded by man. Everybody was astonished at the first balloon flights of the 1780s. And here we have the great philosopher architect Ledoux. This is an eye. Just look at this image for a second. It's an eye. It's actually the Masonic eye, which was over the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill. It's an eye, therefore it's an all-seeing eye. But it's a human eye because it's standing on a stage. Is actually standing in relationship to you, where I am now. It's, let's say, my eye. It's reflecting in its pupil the auditorium, the mass society that is in front of it. It is also reflecting that beam of light which comes from the back say, from the exit sign behind there, onto it and likes it. But what's it doing? It is projecting again out of itself that light back onto the audience, onto the vehicle, onto the world, onto society. And it's quite obvious that this is the architect's eye. One of the first great professional technical architects of the late 18th century is saying, I, architect, can stand where God stood before. And the light you give me, the knowledge you give me of yourselves, I can reflect back on you, and I can give you dwellings that will serve you just as I wish them to serve you, and probably better than you know how. And if this is Ledoux's vision of the universe, this is the vision that the 19th century had of the universe. With iron and steel and steam, you can bridge the planets. You can reorganize progress. The great early 19th century philosopher Henri Saint-Simon, that great philosopher of progress who says, if we go with technique, if we go with industry, if we go with power, if we go with the captains of industry and technique and science, we can make the world perfect. Because through technical reform will come social reform. And here we have a portrait, a caricature of Saint-Simon, the great progressive technologist, walking across the first iron bridge to link the planets. And here are the inhabitants of the Earth coming out on their iron balcony to look at the assembled planets around them. Perfection, unity, harmony, social progress by technique. And that technique was being forged by the instruments of an industrial revolution that was always already massing the proletariat in factories. Here, the Arkwright's new factory of the 1780s, up near Glasgow, and here, the engines, the great steam engines, first in a rural landscape, but then in an urban landscape, which are going to transform the face of production and the face of technique, which are going to transform villages like that into villages like this. Note how the artist here in the late 18th century has to transform his vision of industrial production, which he's never seen before, into an artistic convention of Hades or hell. He's still entrammeled in the grip of a past vision, which he is projecting on a future. The craft workshops are transformed into vast mills of industrial organization and productivity. The way in which the organization of production of iron at the end of the 18th century is gradually through the 19th century, there's Nasmyth and the great steam hammer of 1832, beginning to move towards the perfection of technique in iron and steel. The perfection and the gargantuan expression of such technique. Little factory communities that held together and bonded their societies, such as Robert Owens at New Lanark in 1800, are transformed into the vast sprawling industrial metropolis. Here's Sheffield in 1850 of the first industrial revolution in England. The rural laborer is transformed into the mass industrial proletariat. This is a shock from which society, the whole of society, the owners as well as the workers, have not yet recovered from. In order to defend and develop the productive organization of a very recalcitrant, of a very, very unwilling rural proletariat as it comes into the factories and has to organize according to the canons of the industry, you need even more techniques. And the architect is developing these techniques throughout the 19th century. He's developing plans of things called schools, prisons, asylums, poorhouses, factories, hospitals, insane asylums, and so on and so forth, in order in one way and another to encapsulate, organize, and rationalize the productive capacities of society according to the power of the new industry. Here's a school which makes sure that everybody pays attention. Here's a school, a rational school, displayed and built by the great radical philosopher Jeremy Bentham in his back garden. To it, he invited his neighbor's children, and to it, they did not send their children. But his rational dream was that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 classes, one man, if they're arranged in a circle, I could be giving this lecture to hundreds of people surrounding me. The economy of one master and 6 classes is expressed by the technical invention of what he calls the panopticon, the all-round school, where the master can keep order and speak at the same time to many different groups. Here is prison, a prison that Bentham designs in the 1790s to fulfill similar expectations. Again, it's round. Again, all the prisoners are in cells at the periphery, just like the classes of the school are arranged around the spokes of his wheel. In the center is not a master, but an inspector. There he lives with his nice middle-class family, and there he is an example, as he sits down to his Sunday dinner, to these poor, unfortunate criminals, that their behavior is not unredeemable, that when they go into society, if they act like him, they won't have to come back here again. He is a living moral example of probity, order, and bourgeois mores in the center of this panopticon, making sure that the prisoners, because he can see them from the center all round, panoptically, making sure that they don't misbehave themselves while they're in the prison, but at the same time giving them an example of order and harmony. When they go into the prison schoolroom again, they can be, in one way or another, prevented from disorder and related completely to this single figure of order and authority, which in the end is a figure of rational geometry, the kind of technique that allows these kinds of synoptican prisons to be developed and reduplicated across Europe in the years 1830 to 1900. Enormous cellular blocks, again asylums. Well, in the 18th century, he wasn't sure whether you were mad or not. You were, if you were disturbers of the peace in 18th century society, thrown indiscriminately into various courtyards of places like the Bastille. Here we have a number of insane people being put in a courtyard of the Bastille. They are, in a way, not completely shut off from society. They are not isolated in a specific way. They have no categories of disease or categories of manias classifying them and ratifying their existence as insane. But by the end of the 18th century, you have asylums. Here's George Dance's great asylum in London, St. Luke's, the first great asylum of the late 18th century, the 1790s. And what is he doing? He's using architecture, the environment, as a technique to control the society. How is he doing that? Well, of course, just like the modern movement, this architecture is white. Why is it white? Well, perhaps unlike the modern movement, although sometimes we're not sure, this is white in order to purify these chaotic and insane minds that it incarcerates. Think a bit about some white modern architecture that you know, and wonder or not whether the image of the pure whiteness, purifying the chaos of the 18th century insane minds in these first white asylums of George Dance doesn't in one way or another reflect itself in those endless white prisms of the radiant city. And finally, you have the reality. You have the reality of the individual and the collective. And in one way or the other, the individual and the collective are bound in by the techniques of architecture in the 19th century. The individual is forced to come to rule. Here's a beautiful example from a late 1830, 19th century treatise on teaching. Education, the form of education, the bent tree must be made straight. How can it be made straight? It can be bonded to a straight post, presumably the school teacher, and thus made perfect, rational. Technically and physically, that bent tree is an anagram for this poor penitent, this penitent in a penitentiary. The origin of the word is interesting when you think of its relationship to medieval punishment and medieval chastisement. This man, this individual in a cell, a great panopticon cell, is in fact relating solely not to God. He's bowing down to the master of the prison. He's bowing down to the bureaucrats who staff the office of the Bureau of Prisons. He's bowing down to the state, that great impersonal bureaucratic state that is going to organize industry and society perfectly. And where the state doesn't organize it perfectly, the architect is going to step in. Here is Robert Owen telling us how, if we can't put them in prison, if we can't classify them as insane, if we can't in one way or another put them in school, we can at least reform them in a very special way. How? The architects love this. You can reform their environment. and you can transform this terrible scene. This is your typical working-class family in the 1830s in England. I know many people in England that still believe this is your typical working-class family in England. The baby's got us a gin, the mother's fighting a man who's become an ape from staying too long at the pub. He's probably ripped off some architect's drawing board. Baby's unattended, but the architect steps in. The environmental purifier comes, and he gives him a room, probably the same size as the room he had there. All he needs is some wallpaper with some book backs pasted on it. And maybe an urn, cast iron probably, or pottery if you're a little bit more affluent, of fruit. And maybe a bust of who else but Socrates to inform the daily life of the working man in England. And a harp. And lo, he comes home, he likes his environment, he sits, and we have this pleasant scene of bourgeois harmony. If your workers do this and not that, they'll be much more productive. They can get up in the morning unbleary-eyed from drink and turn off on the factory floor, and they can clock in and clock out according to the times of the factory, as opposed to the times of their hangover. And so the factory goes on and on. Oh, dear. The factory produces these objects of superb 19th century kitsch to populate the houses of the up-and-coming working classes who are being made into nice, neat middle classes. And at this point, something happens to architecture. Something happens to a great number of thinkers and theoreticians and polemicists who have tried continuously to ward off this vision of technique. Victor Hugo, in that wonderful novel, Notre Dame de Paris, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, some of you have probably read. In the second version of it, produces a chapter about architecture. No reading translation, in fact, in the modern master's translation, modern classics. The chapter on architecture is immediately perceptive of this crisis. He has the abbot, or the archdeacon, of Notre Dame, standing in front of his cathedral and waving at that cathedral nothing more nor less than a printed Bible. And he looks at that printed Bible and he says, this printed Bible, will kill that, the cathedral. The book of printing will kill the book of stone. Victor Hugo says, architecture is dead. Architecture in more. Architecture is dead in 1832, and nobody has realized it even now. Architecture is dead. Why? Because it is the printed book which is the medium of communication, of meaning, of the transaction of ideas from the invention of the printing press on. Not the book of stone. Not the stone figures that so concretize the symbolic world of the Middle Ages and even through the Renaissance. And the only meaning we can get is in our new cinema kind of dioramas, when we go inside and we view as middle-class citizens the perspectives of Paris, which we dare not enter because they're full of working-class citizens. And Architecture in Styles, here's Granville's great engraving of the same year. Victor Hugo says, architecture is dead. Granville shows it's dead. It's crystallized. It's ossified. All the styles of architecture have permutated and deposited themselves across a desert, barren desert. And there they remain. Just like the skeletons in Cuvier's anatomy exhibitions of the 1830s. They can be picked up, resurrected, stuck on facades, but in the end, they're nothing more nor less than lifeless bones. Architecture and its styles can be used. We can add it to a steam engine. Here's our column again. in order to make the steam engine dignified. We can add it to a factory in order to make the people in the factory feel that maybe they're working in a church. We can add it in ever-increasing excrescence in the opera, and we can strip it down and build it in technical, ratified form in the central markets. These two interiors, Baltar's central markets layout of the 1850s and Charles Garnier's opera, which still stands in Paris, of the 1860s and 70s, are, in a sense, the epitome of that contradiction which Adolf Loos demonstrated to you in the first slide, the contradiction between architecture and building. And all this is, in relationship to that, is that it's got ornament stuck onto it. It has that structure to hold it up, and inside it, it is decorated. Architecture is simply a set of skeletons pulled out of the historical closet and hung around the walls of building, no more nor less. Architecture is dead, and building is supreme. Building is so supreme that in 1889, you have a building, no, it's not a building, it's a monument, that supreme work of architecture, the monument, the powerful Sanitar. You see in Washington, is the height of symbolic architecture for the tradition of architecture from the Renaissance to the 19th century. And here is Gustav Eiffel having the audacity to build a monument in iron. A new kind of architecture, or the death of architecture and the supremacy of building. Certainly for those who looked at it and divided around it, some of them felt that its new and twisting and moving spaces, its fragmented and intersecting lines, proposed an entirely new spatial vision, proposed a vision of architecture that could be made no longer out of the historical forms of the past, but now out of the tectonic forms of building in the present. We should run with the present. We should go with progress. And maybe we can get Siegfried Gideon's Space, Time, and Architecture is a celebration of this philosophy. And maybe we can get some kind of new vision. A vision that can make some sense of the world. Because our world as we stand now at the end of the 19th century, on the threshold of a second industrial revolution, has disrupted the relationships between this rapidly fading man, the nature, and the machine that he stands in front of, and coagulated them into an amorphous metropolis which you can no longer make sense of. What we now call the modernist vision, the vision of fragmentation, seriality, the vision of the musician Schoenberg, the vision of painter Cézanne and Braque, those kinds of fragmentary visions, first perceived by the Impressionists and then built on by what we call the modernists, are an attempt not to reconstruct the chaotic world with all the classical panoply of organization, hierarchy, proportion, structure, and perspective, but to try and find in that world which has faded a new order which is emerging. An order which is serial, fragmentary, and chaotic. An order very much like the order of the production line. That a conveyor belt which is first invented in Chicago in order to slaughter hogs, and which then is taken over by industry in order to make buckets. And between the mass slaughtering of hogs and the mass production of buckets, there is a vision of seriality, of production and consumption, which informs all attempts to organize and order this new world. This is the Paris of the late 18th and early 19th century. Napoleon's streets in Paris look like that. But this is the vision of the street that the futurist Boccioni saw in 1910. The noise of the street penetrates the silence of the house, is the title of this painting. Nothing is static anymore. Everything is moving. He's trying to capture the essence of modernity, which to him is continual fragmentation, continual fracas, continual movement. F.H. Bradley, a great English philosopher, wrote a book around the same time called Appearance and Reality. where he analyzed the work of the late 19th century scientists and the work of the late 19th century mathematicians, and began to discern that there was no longer possible a vision of reality that said, this is solid and this is void. This is Cartesian space gridded between what is there and what is not there. But we have to have a fragmentary, relativistic vision of things in order to understand nature and therefore to understand the chaotic world of the present. This is the vision of modernism. This is the vision that allowed someone like Georges Braque, the painter, for example, to say, I prefer relationships to objects. I don't like objects. I like the relations between them. They are continually restorative of my understanding of the new order because they are continually permutating and changing as the objects themselves are static and have no validity anymore. Bocioni, tradition. Those who stay. Bocioni, progress, avant-garde, seizing the future, those who go. Let's look a little bit at the vision of those who did go, the modernists at the beginning of the 20th century, who thought that maybe out of all this technique, this great mass of technical vision that had been produced and literally consumed in the 19th century, we can begin to make an entirely new architecture, fusing together now. Not art and building, but making art out of building. Again, the dialectic between architecture, the art of building itself is ramified in, for example, these great propositions of Giacconi, the futurist, who tries to weld together some enormous vision in 1914 of the proposed new city, La Città Nuova, an exhibition that he held with Antonio Santelia, and probably some kind of, I think Freud would have had a very nice time with those two objects there, some kind of vision that goes beyond technology to subsume the flesh. And here we have Antonio Santelia in these enormously vertical cities saying that we have to run with technology. We have to make it out of the bricolage of fabrication that we have presented to us. This bricolage of fabrication that allows Vladimir Pavlin at the beginning of the revolution in Russia in 1917 to say, okay, we can put together the society again and we can put together architecture again, and architecture will once more become the analog of society if we painstakingly take each individual element and build each element up into a kind of Tower of Babel, but no longer is it the kind of Tower of Babel that's going to collapse. It is dynamic, it is not static. It is spiral and it is pointing. It is moving. It is in every way something that points towards the future, that breaks with the past and uses the materials of the present with which to construct. There's one of Pavlin's early collages of pieces of found metal. Metal he found in the production shop. I am a factory, he said. The artist is a factory. He produces out of the materials and methods of the factory. We've now got architecture and building fused on behalf of building and construction. Constructivism, the making of a world, the invention of a world, out of a new technology, a new technique. Here we have the Vesnin brothers making this fantastic rotating set for their production of the G.K. Chesterton novel, The Man Who Is Thursday. And here we have the Pravda building, a great sign, a expression now of the news of society. On this building will be flashed the latest headlines and the latest photographs of what is going on in society. The time, the weather will be broadcast, speeches will be broadcast, great radio masts will communicate with the world and say, we have this new society, we are communicating to each other, and the architectural artifact is part and parcel of that production. We are making, said Melnikov, new social condensers, new forms of constructed institutions that will, in their club-like form and in their community vision, reconstruct society. Here we have the architect saying, before we have to reconstruct society, the Soviet Union in 1945, we have to build the buildings of that reconstruction. If we build the buildings right, the society will be right. The great patrimony of this vision, the constructive vision of constructivism, flows into the visions of Corbusier and the Villiers and the modern movement like a great wave which says, if you get the buildings right, then maybe, perhaps, we hope, surely, the society will follow. If we then imagine a perfect society and imagine a perfect building around which to wrap that society, surely that will follow too. People are not all so sure. Someone like Nesitsky, for example, very much like William Blake at the end of the 18th century in his crisis of industrialization. Nesitsky in his crisis of industrialization says, well, maybe we have to build a little room for ourselves again. Maybe this great ferment of construction, production, and domination of society by the architect is not so good. Maybe we have to find our prune room, ourselves, our essence, prune. Our being, and in that being room we can be. And he starts out of those spaces to construct little fairy tales of construction for himself, very wittily and very beautifully. Again, a response of the mystic to the rationalist, of mystic to the technician. And what does the architect do? The architect of Corbusier turns back to the 18th century, and he says, yes, the 18th century was right. They were absolutely correct. Except when Logier turned back to those four trees, standing in a square with the column, the beams, and the pediment, he just had the technology wrong. What you really need is reinforced concrete. And then you've got your model of a perfect architecture. Then you have something you can work with. Then you have what is in effect the essential ontology of architecture, the fundamentals of architecture represented according to the rules, assembled according to the rules and proportions of geometry. There's the house at Sugarplum, and here's the Domino House. Between 1906 and 1914, Corbusier, like Logier in the 1750s, had it all worked out. And it was worked out on exactly the same principles as the 18th century. Cubes, spheres, cones. This is the real natural form behind surface appearance. And not only can we overcome and organize nature by our disposition of these cubes, these spheres, and these cones, we can also organize what we now see before us as the natural history of produced objects. We can assemble, if you like, on a table, like the scientists Enlightenment assemble all the species of man and all the species of animals and plants and rocks on tables in order to classify them. We can assemble on a table all the objects that are of use to us in our life. The this one.